The confessed Parkland shooter pleads guilty in hopes of avoiding the death penalty. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Families of victims sat nearby as the young man who killed their loved ones told a judge he's pleading guilty to all counts against him. The move is in hopes of avoiding the death penalty. We'll take a look at what happened in court yesterday. Also, State Senator Annette Tadeo is the third Democrat to enter the race for Florida governor in 2022. We'll ask her why she's running and what makes her stand out compared to her Democratic competitors. And finally, there's a lot of misinformation about COVID, and we've seen this before during the 80s and the AIDS epidemic. An exhibit looks at how misinformation can take hold. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, the trial of the confessed Parkland school shooter is moving faster than expected. He pleaded guilty in court yesterday to all of the charges related to the 2018 shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. What he pleads guilty to is 17 counts of first-degree murder and 17 counts of attempted first-degree murder. Now the trial heads to the penalty phase, where he will receive either the death penalty or life in prison. Joining us now is WLRN's Broward reporter, Katie Switalski-Munoz. She was in court yesterday covering the story. Katie, he changed his plea to guilty on all 34 charges related to the shooting. What was his plea before? Why did he change it?
Hi, Lewis. Yes, so the plea before this was not guilty, although his defense counsel, his attorneys, had argued this entire time that he would always plead guilty, or he was ready to plead guilty, if the death penalty were to be taken off the table. Now, the state prosecution has said they are very firmly staying on topic of keeping the death penalty. They were not interested in taking that off the table. And this moment, this change, why now, is an interesting question. But it's believed to be a strategy change. So his defense counsel has clearly counseled him that the evidence against him has mounted. The state has quite a bit of evidence against him, from his confession early on to DNA, witness testimony, surveillance videos. And his counsel sees this as a way to give him the best shot of avoiding the death penalty.
The other thing, too, is that he has also pleaded guilty to four charges related to the assault of a law enforcement officer. This is an attack he made on an officer while he was in jail. I mean, that's a separate thing, though, right?
Yes, separate case. And the aggravated battery, he was sentenced yesterday in that case, and he got 26 years for that attack on the officer while he was in jail. He can serve those years concurrently. So it doesn't really mount up to 26 years, but also he got some credit for about 1,000 days that he's already been in jail.
So he pleads guilty to all 34 charges related again to the school shooting. The judge had to then accept the plea, right?
Yes, she did. She had to determine, Judge Elizabeth Shear had to determine if he was of sound mind to make this decision. And so I'm imagining a lot of people think he just sort of walked in and said, I'm guilty. And it was over very quickly, but it was not. It took a lot of time for the judge asking him at every moment, do you understand the gravity of the decision you are making? Do you understand what you're giving up by pleading guilty at this point in this case? And some of the things that he is, you know, giving up include right to appealing. He cannot, after yesterday, he cannot undo his guilty plea. And so I think what a lot of people don't understand about any case that's going to involve the death penalty is really, it's not one trial, it's really two trials. The first trial, the first phase, if you will, is called the guilt phase. And that is what the confessed school shooter is giving up by pleading guilty. So there will not be a first phase. However, he really still does have to go to trial for the second phase. It's called the penalty phase. And that is when a jury of 12 people will, they're not there to decide if he's guilty or not. That's already, you know, we're moving on from that. They're there to truly just decide, should he spend his life in prison without parole, or should he receive the death penalty. And that's a big distinction, because I think a lot of people hear, oh, we're skipping part of his trial, but really he still does have to go to trial.
All right. And, you know, one of the interesting aspects of this, and I had it on television, but I can only imagine what it must have been like being in that room. After his guilty plea, former Broward State Attorney Mike Satz read a detailed description of the shooter's actions that day, February 14, 2018. What did you see from those who were there when that was being read?
Yeah, it was incredibly emotional, Lewis. No one expected Mike Satz to do that. And
he didn't warn them?
No. The reaction in the room was visceral. I mean, it was quiet, but there were a lot of tears, and you could hear the sniffles, and you could see, I saw this incredible moment that made me tear up. I mean, press were not immune to this. The judge was not immune to this. Everybody was getting choked up, because Mike Satz told the moment by moment, play by play recap of what happened on that horrible day through the perspective of the shooter. And that was very difficult for the families to hear. So there was a lot of people holding their heads. And there was this one moment where I looked over and I saw Tom Hoyer, who lost his son Luke in the shooting. And he put his hand on the back of Fred Guttenberg, who was in tears. And to see these two parents that have both lost their children at sort of what felt like this big pivotal crossroads moment. And they knew it had to be done. I talked to several family members after the plea. They understood that the prosecutor had to lay the groundwork for the penalty phase of this case and had to sort of set the stage for what's to come next. But that didn't make it easy to hear.
Katie, did you look over at the shooter, see his response as all of this is being read?
I did. He had his backs turned to the family for most of this. Even when he made a statement, he had his back to the families. He tried to appear remorseful, and he got choked up as well. But I think, you know, I think he didn't expect that recount of that day either. But I couldn't see his face at that moment.
Mm. Caught everybody off guard. I'm speaking with WLRN's Broward reporter Katie Switalski-Munoz, talking about the trial of the confessed Parkland school shooter. He pleaded guilty to all charges related to the 2018 shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Again, 17 people killed, 17 others injured. The guilty plea means the trial now moves straight to the penalty phase. You can find a link to more of the reporting on this story and a link to the mental health and trauma support resources in South Florida on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Katie, as you said, the confessed shooter made a statement, and that caught people off guard. What did he say?
Yeah, that was also very unexpected. He asked the judge if he could make a statement after he pleaded guilty, and she allowed that. And I think the family viscerally reacted with a lot of shaking heads of, you know, there were some comments of no. But when it was his turn to speak, he sort of hunched over the microphone, again, back to the family members. And he said he's very sorry for what he did and that he has to live with it every day. If he were to get a second chance, he would do everything to try to help others. Part of the speech really sort of probably got off track a little bit. He talked about drugs and believing that this country would do better if people stopped smoking marijuana. And so it was about a minute long. And I think that the families really didn't want to hear it. They were really, really upset that he had the chance to speak. And this was his statement directly to them. And it was not received well at all, as you can imagine.
And one of those parents that you had spoken to, spoke about, Tom Hoyer, again, his son was one of the students killed in the shooting. This is what he said in response to the shooter statement.
When he said he wanted to speak, that was really an ugly surprise for us, because there's nothing he can say that's going to change anything that he did.
And you spoke with other family members, Katie. I'd imagine they were all in shock that he spoke and they didn't like what he said.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I heard that it was ridiculous, that it was irrelevant. And in particular, Gina Hoyer, the wife of Tom Hoyer that you just heard from, she told me she really believes that this is just all legal strategy by his attorneys, right? So his attorneys are, their only goal now is to try to avoid the death penalty. And by making a statement today where he, you know, is remorseful, that's a legal strategy that hopefully his attorneys see being useful in the next phase of this, right? So the families just didn't take it as genuine, and they don't want to hear it at this point.
So with the guilty plea, as you said, we move down to the penalty phase. How does this work? What the jury selection? What's next?
Yes. So I'll tell you, on October 26th, that's next week, there's going to be a hearing, because this case has totally changed direction now, right? Everything that the attorneys on both sides were preparing for kind of gets cut in half, and they just move straight to this second really pivotal part of this. And so on October 26th, they're just going to have a day to go through all of their pretrial motions, see what still applies, see what needs to be changed, and sort of get on the same page now that this change has been made and been made official. But next, really, jury selection begins on January 4th. And there's a couple of key pieces to that. So in Florida, to get the death penalty, 12 jurors need to be unanimous. If one juror decides that the gunman should have life in prison instead, that's the default. That's how the state works.
How long could this take? I mean, part of it is now that he's pleaded guilty, that there was an expectation, oh, this will be quicker now. But did anybody say anything about, like, look, how long might this process take?
It will be quicker, but there are still a few months left of this. What you have to do in the penalty phase of the trial is the state still has to make its case against this confessed gunman. The state is still going to, you know, put that evidence all out there in public court, and you're still going to see videos. You have to go over how each of the 17 people who were killed were killed. And then you have to go over all of the evidence for each of the 17 people who were injured. Some who almost died of their injuries, right? Of how they were injured. And so that's going to take some time. It's still not going to be pretty. And it's not going to be, it's not going to save people from as much of the heartache, I think, as some first initially thought. However, it does still really move this forward a lot faster than it could have gone.
And you had mentioned earlier, too, because he pleads guilty. Did I hear you right? He can't appeal this now?
There are steps to not undoing what he did yesterday. And he does give up some of his rights to appeal based on his plea. And he can't, it gets tricky, but he can't appeal the death penalty because of his plea. In other words, if he is to receive the death penalty, he can't appeal that based on him not being in the right state of mind when he pleaded guilty yesterday. The judge asked him many, many questions to try to make sure and determine that he was of sound mind to make this decision. And another piece of that I just want to mention is to be eligible to receive the death penalty in Florida, you know, some people I have asked me and are wondering, oh, well, he's pleaded guilty. You know, there's not a lot for the jurors in this second phase to do. And yes, there is, because when the state makes their case, to be eligible for the death penalty, someone has to A, be found guilty of the crime, but B, also has to have one of 16 aggravating factors to their case. So there are 16 of those aggravating factors in Florida statute that make someone eligible for the death penalty, you know, committing very cold or calculated or heinous murders are certainly aggravating factors. And the state has said they are going to use each one of the murders as aggravating factors for the other murders in this case. So the state is laying out that they plan to use about 7 of the factors and compound them.
You talked to the families. You've been covering this story for, you know, since the beginning. And I wonder, you talked to the families, and are they all on board? Do they all want the same thing? Do they all want the death penalty?
So the families that I have spoken to are in favor of the death penalty. Now, I'll just make the caveat there that there are a lot of families involved in this, at least 33 families of someone who was killed or injured. Or in the Duarez case, you know, they lost their son and their other son was one of the injured. So there's a lot of emotions there. And I think that this case in particular can challenge anyone's preconceived notions or feelings about the death penalty. So the more outspoken of the parents that I've talked to have told me personally that they are in favor of the death penalty in this case. But I have not spoken to every parent because some really do want to stay private.
What an unbelievable story. One we'll keep following, of course. And as you said, the next phase, going to the penalty phase of this trial, we'll keep following it. WLRN's Broward County reporter, Katie Swetolski-Munoz. Katie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
And again, you can find a link to more of her reporting on this story and a link, again, to mental health and trauma support resources in South Florida on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's switch things up. Still to come. The Democratic field for the gubernatorial race in 2022 is getting bigger. We're going to meet the newest candidate, State Senator Annette Tadeo. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. There are still 383 days before Floridians go to the ballots to pick their next governor. But look, if you know anything about politics in the U.S., the sooner you jump in, the better. Governor Ron DeSantis is going to run for re-election, even though there are questions as to whether or not he's got plans to run for the White House in 2024. On the Democratic side, you've got former governor and Congressman Charlie Crist, also current Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, and now State Senator Annette Tadeo has entered the race. She entered this week. She joins us now to discuss why and why she wants to be the governor. Senator Tadeo, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, if you have a question for the senator, text it in now, 786-677-0767. That's 786-677-0767. You can always email it to us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Governor, or excuse me, Senator, that little slip there. Senator, you as a South Floridian, as a Latina woman, why do you want to run for governor?
Because we need a governor that will represent all Floridians, not just those that vote for us, not just those that will vote or vote in Ohio. We need a governor that's actually worried about the well-being of Floridians right here in Florida, and that it's not making decisions based on a future political ambition, but actually for the betterment of all Floridians.
But why do you think you stand a better chance against Governor DeSantis, also against Charlie Crist and Nikki Fried?
Look, this race is not about Charlie or about Nikki or about me, for that matter. It's about the future of our party and our state. And I can tell you this, I have great respect for Charlie Crist. I know he has a huge heart. I ran with him as his running mate in 2014. And I know that if I'm the nominee, Charlie will stand shoulder to shoulder with me to fight for Florida, and I will do the same. But I also know that after taking time, and I did take my time to travel the state, listen to so many people, not just from my party, but also across the state, independents, Hispanics, African-Americans, I offer unique stories that will help us build the winning coalition. As a mom with a kid in public schools, a Hispanic small business owner who is living proof what can happen when we work hard to achieve the American dream story.
What was the process like for you? What were you thinking about? I'm wondering how long you were thinking about this, because I know that you'd been talking about it with some folks over time, but you know, when did you finally decide, yeah, I need to do this?
Well, actually, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And frankly, a lot of people had approached me way back when we saw the results in Miami-Dade County and the erosion of the Hispanic vote from the Democratic Party. So that those conversations started then. But what ultimately brought me to say, I have to do this, is I am a mom first and foremost, and I do have a kid in public school. And this governor, when he puts politics in front of the well-being of Floridians, and specifically our kids playing games with masking and talking about removing duly elected school board members that are simply trying to respond to the people that elected them and their job, which is number one, to protect the kids. And even counties where, you know, now they're being sued for millions of dollars because they're doing what they feel is in the best interest to protect their residents. And this is the kind of stuff that we see in Venezuela with Maduro. So this is completely unacceptable. And it was then and there that I said, I cannot stand in the sidelines. I will get in and fight. I've always been a fighter, never been afraid of a tough race. And if I would have been afraid, I would have never won my special election. Nobody thought we could win.
That was in 2017. You know what? Before you even have to take on DeSantis, again, you've got to take on two well-known figures. Again, Charlie Crist, as you said, you were his running mate in 2014, and Nikki Fried, who's currently the ag commissioner. You jump in at this moment too, when they've been building up their war chest. They're building up their money, which is necessary. How do you make up for that time, and how do you win over donors again against two well-known names?
Well, I will tell you, in 2018, we saw both sides have primaries where the nominees started as underdogs and were discounted early on. I believe we have a clear path forward because so many in our party want to have a fighter in their nominee, someone who is battle tested, that has won tough races and is prepared to bring together a coalition of voters who can carry us through the finish line, not just in the primary, but in the general. Look, I know our campaign can do that both in the primary and the general, and those who discount underdogs do so by choosing to ignore history.
We're talking with State Senator Annette Tadeo. She's the latest to join the race to become Florida's next governor. She is going to be competing right now with Congressman Charlie Crist and the state's current agriculture commissioner, Nikki Fried. These are the names we have so far. You can find more of our coverage of this race on our social media, WLRN Sundial. But if you have a question for the senator, you can text it in now, 786-677-0767, or you can email it, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Senator, President Trump won Florida in 2020, and one of the big challenges that Democrats could not overcome, and you kind of touched on this a moment ago, you said Maduro's name, and yet that's what the Republicans were doing to the Democrats. They were branding you as socialist, and they were comparing you to the socialists of Venezuela, the communists and socialists of Cuba, and other Latin American countries. I don't know what their strategy is, but hey, if it worked before, they'll probably do it again. If they do, how exactly do you overcome that?
I will overcome it the way I overcame it when they tried it on me and it didn't work. They didn't just call me a socialist and a comunista. They also called me a terrorist sympathizer. And we did not take it laying down. We fought back with my personal story, talking about my experience, the daughter of a fighter pilot who fought in World War II, the Nazis, and then went to Colombia, fell in love with my mother. And obviously during the troubled times of the 80s, my father was kidnapped by the FARC terrorist group. And, you know, our entire farm was taken over by them, and we had to flee. And so this experience of mine is not much different than the experiences from so many people in our state that have had to flee, whether it's because of communism, socialism, or terrorism. They're all intertwined, and we need to fight back the ridiculousness. And look, I know that we were successful in fighting back. I know we can be successful in fighting back, and that's exactly what we will do. And that is another reason why I need to be the nominee, because yes, they will try this. And that's why I push back on the governor when he's the one that is behaving like Maduro. And he's the one doing things like that.
You spend quite a bit of time on Spanish language media here in South Florida, and we've seen reports that some of these outlets are allowing the spread of false information about the election, about vaccines, about QAnon conspiracies. How do you battle that? And why do you think that's been so successful? Some of these things have latched on in this community.
It is really troubling, and how sad that to retain power, you have to go to such lengths to spread misinformation. But that is exactly what the Republican Party is doing, and hanging on to that QAnon and Trumpism that has been so unhealthy. And frankly, the way you fight it back is by having voices that people trust, and that, you know, they know that when necessary, we're willing to criticize our own party or our own president. And these are things that you just said, I'm on Spanish radio and TV a lot, and that I'm known as somebody who's not afraid to speak up when I see a wrong, no matter which side it comes from.
But how do you do it? You know, because, for example, and it's not just Spanish language media. We've obviously seen it in other media where, again, you'll have these falsehoods or some of these conspiracies that just keep growing. What is the strategy when somebody brings that up? How do you fight that?
You have to fight it with real information and facts. And look, there are some people that are gone too far, but there are those people that are willing to listen if they trust the messenger. And this is why it's so important for us not to let these messages just continue to repeat themselves. And we have to be present all the time fighting back, because they are present right now with this information. And we're not even in a race really yet. And that shows how concerned they are about the fact that we're going to be successful, because unless they spread this misinformation.
Again, the number 786-677-0767 to text in a question, or you can email at sundial@wlrnnews.org. Talking with State Senator Annette Tadeo, the latest Democrat to jump into the race for the governor's race for 2022. She's taking on Charlie Crist and Nikki Fried. You talked about criticizing your own party. Democrats really fumbled Florida in the last election. What's the big criticism that you have of your party? What has to change?
Well, first and foremost, we have to register voters and continue to register voters and register more voters. And that is something that we have gotten behind on.
Right now, the Republicans are catching up.
Yes, they sure are. But also Florida, the reality is Florida is a state that is decided by 1% or less historically. And so really part of our issue in us really being able to win is bringing the coalition of voters that is going to take. Look, we saw with the last election that it was the closest ever. I'm talking about the gubernatorial election with Gillum and DeSantis. And clearly we came so, so close with a minority candidate. And I think with a Demings Tadeo top ticket duo, we can energize voters across the state and grow support among the pivotal MPA voters who are so disgusted with the divisive politics of today. That I can tell you, I know they are. I know we can get there. We just have to believe we can win. We have to work hard. And I sure believe we can win with a Demings Tadeo ticket at the top.
Again, 786-677-0767. If you have a question for State Senator Annette Tadeo about her running for the governor's office, we did hear from Jack in Fort Lauderdale. And he asked this question, Senator, what steps would be taken to deal with addiction and homelessness in South Florida, in Florida in general, because now you've got to worry about the entire state?
Look, we definitely have an addiction problem, and we've actually worked a little bit on it in a bipartisan way at the legislature, but, you know, some of the few things we have actually tackled. When it comes to homelessness and just period affordable housing, you know, some counties have had to take it on their own, and Miami-Dade is a prime example of a place that has really done great things when it comes to combating homelessness, because we tax ourselves so that we can have the proper infrastructure to help those people. But we have an affordable housing crisis. And a lot of the people that are being evicted right now from homes is a problem that we're dealing with. And I deal with it at my Senate office with people calling, and I have to get on the phone myself. Just last week, had to get on the phone myself to call the secretary of DCF because mother and her kids were being evicted at no fault of her own. The checks was written to the wrong place. And so these are the kinds of things that really frustrate one. But there are lots of resources that came from the federal government that are not making it to the people. And I don't understand why we're not moving that money to the people that need it most, especially since the package was approved and the money was sent from the federal government.
You know, one of the things running for governor, as you already know, again, because you were on the ticket with Crist, is, all right, now you got to look at the issues that are important to everybody, not just here in South Florida, but southeastern Florida, the panhandle, Central Florida, et cetera. Well, what do you think are going to be the three big issues for this upcoming election that are going to be hotly debated?
Look, obviously, COVID continues to be a big issue. And right now we have a governor that is literally saying he's going to call a special session next month to not allow private businesses to run their businesses how they see fit to keep their employees and their customers safe. As you know, some businesses, including Disney, have had a mandate for the vaccine. And we know we just had this uptick throughout the summer from the Delta variant. Finally, we're starting to see a downturn because so many people who had not been vaccinated all of a sudden saw the light, started getting vaccinated. And so many different areas have taken it upon themselves to say inside of certain buildings, you have to wear masks. We had school boards who put in mask mandates against the governor's wishes, and it's unfortunate that this is what has become, that we don't let local communities do the thing. So that is going to be a big issue. But one thing that I am definitely highlighting, besides all the things I care about, but one is the expansion of Medicaid. I have been fighting for this the entire time I've been in Tallahassee. It is frankly criminal that we have not expanded it. There's only 12 states in the entire nation that have not done it. And I challenge everyone to find me one Republican state that has expanded Medicaid and has said, you know what, we made a mistake. Here, take the money back. We're gonna go back to the way we were. Nobody's doing that because it's a sound business decision. I want people who are listening to us to know that if you have health insurance, maybe you say that's the problem of those million Floridians who don't have health insurance, but it is our problem because everybody who has health insurance has a hidden tax every time they go to the hospital. $2,000. And this is not Annette Tadeo making up numbers. This is the Chamber of Commerce study that shows you that we have a hidden tax of $2,000 for every hospital.
Medicaid, always a hotly debated topic. Oh, wait, let me give you a possibility here. So let's say that you win the governor's office. Chances are the House and Senate are still going to be Republican. So how are you going to find success? If
100%, I agree with you. It is going to be Republican. And actually, I've thought about this. Who would be the best Democrat to be in Tallahassee that actually is respected across the aisle, works very well across the aisle, in spite of being a proud Democrat and never, getting away from our values? And I can tell you from my conversations and from my count, we have the votes in the House and in the Senate to pass this. We just don't have the leadership from the governor to do it.
You're saying that it's you. You'd be the best Democrat for this. But look, we've seen across the country Democratic governors dealing with Republicans, in charge of the House and Senate in many other states, and they make life miserable for that Democrat.
100%. And I think they will try no matter who it is. But please don't forget, the governor has the veto pen and you have to definitely use it in a way to get your agenda moving forward. Will it take give and take? Absolutely. But you better use that veto pen to get your priorities done.
Look, here's the reality. I'm going to finish with this. Here's the reality of politics. It can get ugly. And, you know, you're going to have to take on Crist and Fried. And again, you may have that friendship with Charlie Crist, but this is about winning. And so I'm wondering, what's the strategy for you? Are you down the center Democrat, or do you have to lean a little bit more left? The Democratic Party right now is just as torn as the Republican Party and trying to find its identity. Which way is Annette Tadeo going?
Annette Tadeo is going the way she's always gone. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I have always been very proud of my Democratic values, never in any way diverge from them, while at the same time representing everyone, including those that did not vote for me. And that is how we're going to win. And I will tell you, we have done our studies of what happens when people find out that they have an option. And I will tell you, from going all across the state and talking to people, the phone calls and the calls for me to get in this race got louder and louder as time went by, because people want a fighter. People want a lifelong Democrat. People want someone that they believe can win, not just in the primary, but in the general. And what we see in the numbers is when people see that they have an option, and someone with my background, a small business owner, and by the way, even in the panhandle, these calls were coming from. Why? Because they know my experience living in a farm, growing up in a farm, and then moving not to Miami, but to Alabama from Columbia, and having to graduate high school and college in Alabama. So that Southern Bible Belt experience of mine definitely connects with those voters in the north part of Florida. And I will be campaigning all throughout the state to gain the votes necessary to win the primary and then the general.
Well, I will remind people again, we still have more than a year, so lots of time. State Senator Annette Tadeo, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
And we will be talking again soon. And again, you know, just to mention, the three people right now in the Democratic race for the primary, it is Charlie Crist, Nikki Fried, and Annette Tadeo. And we will continue to, you know, follow up any other candidates that jump into the race. We'll bring them to you so that you get to know them. But still, 383 days, lots of time. And by the way, you know what? You can join our Sundial Text Club, because that's the easiest way if you wanted to share any of your comments or questions about any of the guests. Next time we have a politician on, you want to ask a question, join the text club. It's the easiest way. 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Just type the word hello. You'll join the text club. And in the future, you can then post your comments or questions very easily through that. All right, still to come, a new exhibit shows the parallels of misinformation that were spread at the start of the AIDS epidemic and now during the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The AIDS epidemic was one of the defining moments of the 1980s. Myths and falsehoods about the new illness spread like wildfire in newspapers, on television, and in public spaces, much like what's happening now, largely on social media, with COVID. Hunter Ohanian is the executive director at the museum. He curated an exhibit all about the misinformation at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic and how it compares with the misinformation spread during today's pandemic. And again, that's the Stonewall National Museum and Archives. Hunter, it's such a pleasure to have you. My understanding, by the way, Hunter, is that you were in college in the 80s during the start of the AIDS crisis, right?
That's right. Hello, Lewis. It's nice to be here with you. Yes, indeed. I was in college in Boston at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And sort of to put this in some kind of context, I mean, AIDS sort of came into the general population and even some members of the gay community's population in the early 1980s. There was a seminal moment in July of 1981 in which there was a story in the New York Times talking about cohorts of men in Los Angeles and New York that were coming down with this mysterious cancer called KS. And I remember being in college or just out of college at that time, and being with my boyfriend at the time and another individual, and the idea that there could be a disease that would actually affect a particular group of people in this way. I remember it was as if you couldn't imagine it. There was a disassociation with the possibility. Of course, today we know that it actually did happen, but it was definitely something that I experienced myself.
You think about all, again, the information, because there were so many questions people didn't understand. And so that when you don't have an understanding, it's easy for misinformation to get around. I'm wondering, when you look now at the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, was there a moment where you started to see parallels of like the misinformation back in the AIDS crisis and the misinformation of this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was very early on in the COVID crisis when we saw government leaders point fingers at other ethnic groups. The Chinese were being blamed in the beginning, and then there was a parallel that you felt about going back to the days that only Haitians or drug users or gay people could get AIDS. And then when you started seeing claims about treatments and cures, I started feeling last summer that there were a lot of parallels there as well, too. And then this distrust in the medical community, the distrust of the medical establishment, that we can't trust vaccines, or the medical establishment or the government have another agenda here. They began kind of stitching together very, very neatly for me. I began feeling like it was the same things that were happening 40 years later with regard to HIV. At the Stonewall Library, of course, most people know we're located here in Fort Lauderdale. And in the library itself, there are over 28,000 volumes. In the archive, there are over 6 million pages, mostly of serials and newspapers, gay-related, many going back to 1950 to the present day. But there is a collection of books that we have hung on to. They're not on the public-facing shelves. But there, about 5 years ago, a group, a small medical team came and looked at the AIDS collection that we had, and they took about 100 titles off the public-facing shelves because they contained information which was no longer accurate.
That's amazing that you had all these books, and they were, because they were wrong.
Correct, because they were completely wrong. They were what people had thought at that time, but it was important for us not to have them on the public-facing shelves, because if somebody's seroconverted today, of course, we wouldn't want them to get the wrong information.
But why did you keep them?
We kept them because they were an important part of gay culture. This is an important piece of what the gay community went through in the 1980s and 90s. It's part of what our heritage about. The misinformation and the lack of information is part of the experience that we had. So what I did is I went back to some of those old books, and then also I traced some of the early gay publications, names like the New York Native, which was in New York, the Bay Area Reporter in San Francisco, the Gay Community News in Boston, David here in South Florida, the Gay City Times in Chicago. And I began to stitch together the stories that were in the books and those newspapers. And you could see the misinformation that was being spread out and how similar it is to the misinformation that the American population and the world has looked at for the last year and a half.
So interesting to see that after all these years, you'd think that we'd be better, but we're doing a lot of the same thing. Again, I'm talking with Hunter Ohanian. He's the executive director of the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, and he's curated a new exhibit that explores the misinformation at the start of the AIDS epidemic and the comparing it to the misinformation that we see now during the COVID-19 pandemic. And the exhibit opens to the public tomorrow until, I believe it's the beginning of next year. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, one of the interesting things too, Hunter, is the misinformation can stick for many, many years. You look at what happened in the 80s. Society made gay men the unofficial symbol of the AIDS epidemic. How did that affect the gay community? And is that stuck to today? Is it still going today?
Yes, I think it's very much true today. I mean, clearly we have a lot more information and clearly we have treatment. We don't have a cure with regard to HIV and AIDS, but there are a number of things that we know for sure. We know that it's related to a virus. We know that there's treatment that can happen. We know that there is an effective test that you can actually find out. You know, early on in the crisis, there was a whole push among the gay community and gay doctors to not even take an HIV test because they thought it was the government trying to get information about you. And so to your question about how does it still affect gay people today, you can ask any 30-year-old gay man whether or not if he were to have a relationship with somebody else, his mother would believe he was putting himself at risk at AIDS. You can ask any gay man in their 60s if they've lived their entire life with whether or not they can give blood to a blood bank, even though all of the blood is tested today. And so there are these stereotypes and the stigma that continues to exist as a result of it.
What was it like putting together this exhibit? Because you're going back in time, you're looking at, you know, how society just, we missed it. We didn't get it. But then you're looking at today and you're like, whoa, wait a second. We're still doing the same thing.
That's a great question. I have to say, over the years, I've put together many shows here and other places. I personally had had a difficult time with this show, just actually getting through the material, trying to really understand what the truth was and what the common themes were. But going back and looking at the period of time in which young gay men who were healthy in every other way, their faces were covered with sores because of KS. Airline flight attendants were being fired because the fact that they might be gay. By seeing people grasping at straws about the idea that they would take anything, they would take high doses of vitamin C. Or people grasping at straws and just saying, this is the medical establishment. One big theory at the time was that it was the medical establishment who had failed to cure or to prove that a virus was the cause of cancer. And therefore, this was the myth, that the medical establishment was just trying to latch on to HIV to get more funding. Mm. Or there's some people, you go back and you see some of this stuff where they thought this was entirely political, that it was the liberal media and the liberal press and the academic community who were just pandering to a particular lifestyle, as they said.
And you know, the other thing too, by the way, I apologize to jump in, is that, again, this was all happening back in the 80s. So it was the mainstream media where you saw so much misinformation. Today, so much of it is social media. What do you think would have happened if we had social media back in the 80s?
I think we'd be seeing exactly the same thing that we're seeing today. I mean, in the sense that people don't get as much information through television and through newspapers as they do through social media, unfortunately. So it was simply the same. It was misinformation coming out in another way. One thing which is different, too, is that in the beginning part of the early years of the AIDS epidemic, homosexual men were considered disposable. They were considered perverts within society, and there was no big rush to help them out. What's different today is that, of course, we see COVID affecting many people across the board, and the government came out and came up with a vaccine in a very short period of time. Yeah. Would we have liked to see the same thing have happened 40 years ago? Of course. But it is a different time period.
You want to think the world has gotten better. We've gotten better. And in some ways we have. But looking at some of the pieces that you have, it's like, wow, even with social media or not, no, we're still doing too many of the same things. Remind us again how long the exhibit's going to run.
So the exhibit will open tomorrow. It's here at the Stonewall Library on on East Sunrise in Fort Lauderdale, and it will be up until the end of July. We're open Monday through Friday and Saturdays as well. And of course, people can read everything about it at stonewall-museum.org. And October is LGBTQ History Month. And so this is a great opportunity for gay or straight, for people to immerse themselves in an important piece of 20th century contemporary culture.
It is truly a fascinating comparison and parallel. Hunter Ohanian, again, Executive Director of the Stonewall National Museum and Archives. Again, just as he said, you know, you can go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, and link on to their website and find out about it. Something to check out. Hunter, thank you for sharing with us so much.
Lewis, thank you, and thank you for all the good work you do.
Appreciate it. That's our program for this Thursday, October 21st. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Amber Amortigi is helping out with production. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Find them at gobalo.com. Coming up next week, we're going to be talking about the Surfside tragedy again and some proposed changes to condo associations. Email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. If you're part of one, we'd love to hear your thoughts on what should change. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourselves. Have a great Friday and a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.